Pop that door open. It's got to be hiding inside that storage compartment. Keevy was the closest, and she didn't shirk her duty. She stepped up and shouldered the damaged door open. A pall of vapor swirled out into her face in the middle of that smoky wreath. An appendage of some kind stretched after her. Shit! She shouted, backpedaling. Now, I'm not a squeamish man, but this reaching limb made my hair stand on end. The alien appendage looked like a brownish-gray claw with hard black nodules all over it. But that wasn't the strangest part. What really got me was how long it was. That limb had to be longer than any man's arm I'd ever seen. It just kept reaching and reaching, as if it was telescoping somehow after Keevy. She backed over a dead body and went sprawling. Sitting on her butt, she got her rifle up and sprayed fire at the approaching horror. The monstrous limb terminated in a spray of seven grasping fingers, each of which were as thick as Winslade's wrist. Orange fire burst from the muzzle of her gun, and she was joined by several other troops who were close enough to help. The monster shuddered but didn't stop coming. Pieces of it flew off, snapping and splintering. The flesh was white inside, kind of like wood, but there was too much liquid flowing out for it to be real wood. Slippery, thick fluid splattered all over Keevy and the other soldiers who'd rushed near. "Use your force blades," I shouted. "Bullets are just pissing it off." The truth was worse than that. Keevy's armor was already smoking. Her visor was pitted and gray. It had been splashed with acid. Still, she and the others managed to get their blades turned on, and they slashed off the grasping alien limb. It fell onto the deck and dripped and smoked, but it didn't squirm around. It was dead once disconnected from the rest of the monster. I realized at that moment what this thing was. My first, honest-to-God, monster. I'd seen more than my share of aliens, but these things, they were different. They weren't right. There was no earthly equivalent that I could compare them to. We tore the monster apart, blasting it with bullets and hacking off its limbs. I ordered Sargon to hold back with his heavy weapon. There wasn't room for a safe, direct blast. I could only imagine what would happen if this thing unloaded all its acid at once in our direction. At the last moment before it died, it surged toward us, dragging itself out of the doorway into the passage with a wild heave of its limbs. It made a clacking sound and threw itself into our midst. Keevy was its goal. I could see that right off. She tried to get away, and I felt a pang. I shouldn't have let her sit there and fire at the thing that had attacked her. I should have had someone pull her to her feet and drag her out. Grimly determined, the monster hugged her and sort of squatted over her. Prongs of some kind stabbed and scrabbled on her armor while she struggled and cried out. We all laid into it then. After about 20 seconds of blasting and beating on the thing, we took it down at last. It was a good effort, but we were too late to save Keevy. She lay on her back, coughing and writhing. Her faceplate was cracked and fogged up. Her armor looked like it had been run over by a truck. "Are you burning?" I asked her, kneeling beside her.
"Some," she said, her voice choking. "It's the smoke. I can't breathe. The acid penetrated my faceplate."
"Drag her out of here," I ordered. Carlos and Sargon did the honors, taking her back to Graves in the main hallway. We swept the rest of the passageway and declared it clear. Carlos reported back to me after that, and the news wasn't good.
"The vapor killed Keevy, as far as I can tell," he said. "The smoke was poisonous."
I nodded grimly, and we pressed ahead. The other squads had similar experiences. It seemed like the aliens preferred to leave their kind behind when injured. The wounded monsters holed up and lay in wait for humans to wander by. Was that part of their tactics? Did these things even have natural behavior? I had no idea. Each time we met up with resistance, it was a single alien. They fought to the death with relentless fury, using whatever they had left in them to do as much damage to us as they could. Still, we cleared our zone over a 10-minute period. Other units were doing the same all over Blue Deck. Then, finally, Graves brought the rest of the unit in to support our platoon. As Leeson and Johnson hadn't had much contact with the enemy and no casualties, he ordered them to take the lead and press on toward the second hatch. That's where we found a full nest of creatures waiting for us. Chapter 12. Johnson's squad was ambushed and mauled just moments after rushing past the acid-burned hatch. This time we didn't encounter a lone, wounded monster left for the humans to find and exterminate. There were at least a dozen of them. The enemy was waiting on each side of the entrance in hungry groups. Johnson's weaponeer got off a burning shot, but the man had cranked his belcher for a wide-angle cone of fire. It simply wasn't effective. To kill these aliens with a belcher took a focused, hard-hitting beam set for a full-second burn. I guess Johnson hadn't gotten the memo on that one. The weaponeer managed to singe several of the enemy, but all that did was send them into a rattling frenzy. The aliens were left with cooked skin, but they were far from dead. Surrounding Johnson's squad, their long, smoking arms reached out and plucked away rifles, arms, and even heads. Acid streams squirted next, hosing down the clumped troops. The purposeful spraying of acid, that was a new one. Up until now, we'd faced only wounded, weakened creatures. They'd only splashed us with acid when they were torn up. That's when the acid leaked out like splattered blood. But apparently, when these monsters were intact, they possessed the power to eject their foul, caustic liquids with accuracy and at will. The fight was over within 30 seconds. Johnson's squad had advanced through the hatch, and most of them died horribly. Harris and I watched, unable to help since we couldn't fire down the passageway into the open hatch without hitting our own troops in the back. If we rushed in, we'd be so crowded in the cramped space, we'd join the victims. What was left of Johnson's squad fell back, with Leeson and a few others making it back to our line. Leeson had been embedded with Johnson, and he'd gone in with the squad and made it back out. With one eye burned away, Leeson was dying in my arms. Like the others from his ill-fated group, his armor was riddled with smoldering holes, the flesh bubbling beneath. He tried to tell me something, but I couldn't make out the words. I looked at Harris, who was making a gesture behind Leeson's back, a throat-slitting gesture. I got it then. Leeson was asking me to kill him. I took out my sidearm and put the muzzle into his faceplate. Leeson looked grateful, but then he passed out and slumped. Carlos checked his vitals immediately.
"You can put that away, McGill. He's gone."
I holstered my weapon, feeling a degree of relief. I'd put down men in agony before, or those who were in danger of being captured. I'd never enjoyed it.
"Second squad, advance," Graves said from behind me.
The centurion's voice was even and seemed unconcerned. Harris was in charge of second squad. He didn't look happy, not at all.
"Sir," he asked, "shouldn't our platoon get a break? We just lost our adjunct and a whole damn squad with them after all." "Harris," Graves interrupted, "you're in command of your platoon now. We've been proceeding with caution up until now, but our orders have changed. We've been directed to get to the revival machines within the next 5 minutes and report. Your squad has the most experience with this enemy at this point. You're going to get in there and clean them out for me."
"Well, sir," Harris said angrily, "if this is so important, might I suggest Winslay bring his skinny ass down here and personally help out?"
Everyone looked at Harris, but they didn't say anything. This was an unusual display for him. He rarely back-talked Graves or otherwise bucked the chain of command publicly. Even Graves seemed a little surprised. The centurion stepped forward and eyed Harris coldly.
"Chicken?"
Graves asked.
"No, sir, not at all. I don't mind dying. I've done it more times than I can count."
"Sure," Graves said. "When you know you'll come back, You're all balls. All right, Harris. Fine.
His eyes scanned the rest of us in the vicinity.
McGill, show Harris how it's done.
Yes, Centurion, I said with a heavy heart. Graves nodded approvingly, looking me over. He pointed to the smoking mess of burnt bodies and alien matter that had slimed up the entrance to the center of Blue Deck.
Penetrate that enemy position and defeat them in detail, McGill.
Graves ordered me.
Harris, consider yourself under McGill's command for the duration of this action. Go!
Harris's mouth twisted up like he smelled a dead skunk. Graves knew what he was doing. He'd put me in charge of Harris, to shame him. But it was more than that. Harris was my senior, and he'd long had a problem with my rapid rise in the Legion. In my opinion, that was due to a mixture of envy and outrage. As he'd often pointed out, I was likely to go off script. Only in a Legion like Varus, which respected results above all else, could I have gotten away with so much. Slapping a fresh magazine into my rifle, I waved my squad forward. As I did so, I gave my head a little shake. I had to get my brain into this game if I was going to survive the next few minutes. Thinking fast, I put up my fist before we reached the mess at the hatchway. Two squads behind me halted. I couldn't charge in and repeat Johnson's mistakes. I went down on one knee and my people huddled up.
Okay, I said. We don't want to repeat Johnson's mistakes. He rushed in there and got himself ambushed. We have to lure them out to us.
How the hell are we going to do that?
Harris snapped. I didn't look at him. I focused on Della instead.
You're fast on your feet, I told her.
She studied me with big eyes. She didn't even nod in recognition of the compliment. It was true, she was fast and agile, but she didn't want to admit it. I figured she already had some idea where I was going with this.
Trot up there with a grav plasma grenade, I told her. Toss it in and run back before they can grab you. Then race back to our lines. Your mission is to piss them off enough to chase you. When they come out, we'll blast them.
Della licked her lips once.
Is this because of the mud pit?
She asked me.
No, girl, you're honestly the slipperiest trooper in the unit. Don't worry, you'll make it.
Harris, Carlos, and the rest of us watched her pop out a grenade, roll it between her fingers, and then nod. She ran off like a gazelle after that. She was in heavy armor, same as the rest of us, but she moved like she was in gym class.
She's powered up her exoskeleton to full, Carlos said. She must have. No weapons output, no shielding, plenty of speed.
I nodded appreciatively.
Yeah, that sounds right.
That's crazy, Harris said, frowning. If they catch her, they'll burn her fast.
I knew it was true, but I figured Della could play it her own way. She was the one doing the dying, after all. Kneeling, I took careful aim. All around me, a dozen others took up firing positions, altering their weapons into rifle mode. We aimed at the hatchway, which was still wreathed in a haze, but not hidden behind roiling coils of smoke as it had been earlier.
Crazy,
muttered Harris again, watching Della with me.
It's her death and her call, I said to Harris.
He frowned fiercely at me, but didn't say anything else. Among Legionnaires, it was a generally accepted premise that if a trooper took a suicidal assignment, they should be allowed to die in their own damned way. That's because we'd all died multiple times, and we felt a soldier had a right to make certain decisions when the end was near. This unofficial rule was part of our Legion culture, I guess you could say, like allowing a condemned man a last meal or giving him a choice between a firing squad and hanging. It was ingrained in us, part of our code of honor. Della reached the hatch and crept up to it from the left side. She was slinking low, almost on her knees. In her hand was a live grenade.
I said 5 minutes, McGill.
Graves buzzed in my helmet.
Not 5 hours. You've already blown about 3 minutes screwing around.
Taking action now, sir, I reported back.
Della didn't just toss in her grenade. She sprang through the hatch into the dark interior. I cursed under my breath and aimed just over her head, hoping to catch the reaching arm of an alien that tried to scoop her up. A blue-white light flickered.
She tossed in the grenade, Harris said. Ready up, boys. If she's got one on her tail, we best blast them both down together.
I tensed, waiting to order him to give her a chance, but I didn't. A quick death for Della might well be a blessing under the circumstances. For about 2 seconds, nothing else happened. The grenade was on a timed burn and was gathering power for a single convulsive implosion. Grav plasma grenades drew in everything around them, then spat that material back out as shrapnel. Even water could be used as a weapon. In the last second, Della sprang back out of the hatch and sprinted to the left. One bizarrely long arm lunged after her, then another. The grenade went off, releasing a shock wave and a shower of alien blood and body parts. The debris had been weaponized, and although I doubted it could kill the aliens, I had no doubt they felt it. Flailing and scrabbling, the arms moved with greater speed, if less purpose. After a moment of confusion, during which Della sprinted back toward us, they got moving. Sure enough, they surged through the hatch, chasing after her. "Fire!" I roared, and we all opened up. One rank of troops was down on their bellies in front of me. The second rank stood above, firing over the heads of the first rank. That way, along with our weaponeers, we had an impressive amount of destruction flying downrange into the enemy charge. Della threw herself onto the deck and crawled. She was as fearful of being caught by a stray round as she was being snagged by an alien claw. The aliens had really taken the bait. They charged us in a single mass. We blazed at them with everything we had in return. Up until now, most of the fighting had been pretty one way. The enemy had possessed all the advantages and delivered all the surprises. This time was different. We tore them apart. They never made it across the 30 meters or so that separated our position from theirs. When it was all over, 11 alien corpses lay shredded and oozing on the deck. Della reached our line, panting but alive. She had burning acid spots on her boots and leggings, but she was safe. I stood up and strode forward. Sargon was on my right and Carlos on my left. We advanced into the hatchway, but found nothing there that still lived, alien or human. "Hatchway secured, Centurion," I announced to Graves.
"Well done, McGill. Your platoon is relieved. Adjunct Toro, take point. Column advance."
Harris wouldn't meet my eye. After Toro's fighters moved up, Harris marched after me, marshaling his own troops with his usual butt-kicking flair. Was he a little harsher on his squad than usual? I don't know. With him, it was hard to tell. Della came up to me after we'd passed into the inner region of Blue Deck, and we began taking stock of things. It was pretty much a mess in there. The bio people were present and accounted for, at least their dead bodies were. We met no further resistance.
"Why'd you send me in?"
Della asked when we had a second to relax.
"I told you. You're the fastest. You've got the moves, girl."
She looked at me intently.
"You've barely spoken to me since we left Earth," she said. "You're blaming me for the death of your family, aren't you? That's unfair, James."
My head cocked to one side, and I frowned at her in honest confusion.
"I what? No, that's not it at all. I don't blame you. I blame the bastard raiders who live on this planet. They killed my folks, not you."
"I've been reading psychology books since I came to Earth," Della said. "I wanted to have a better understanding of our cultural differences. I believe you're exhibiting a classic example of displacement."
I almost laughed, but I knew that rarely went over well with upset women.
"Displacement? Hardly. I place all the blame squarely on the enemy. That's it. Case closed. Listen, Della, I don't know much about psychology except that it's mostly horse shit. Don't get all caught up in that stuff."
"I accept that you believe your statements to be true," she said. "But that doesn't mean that they are."
So saying, she walked away. Left wishing I could scratch my head through my helmet, I stared after her. In my opinion, she was making things more complicated than they had to be. I'd been avoiding her a bit, sure. But that wasn't because I was mad at her. I was a man whose attentions tended to wander. That was the plain truth.
But lots of people seem to have trouble with that fact and like to make it complicated.
Chapter 13. In the very heart of Blue Deck existed the protected guts of our medical technology, the revival chambers. Inside each room was a single machine. Serviced by a gaggle of lab coat-wearing professionals, these machines were the most valuable resources our Legion possessed. The revival units themselves were, well, strange. They were part electronic, part biological, and part something else I couldn't hope to understand. These machines had the power to grow a biological entity within their guts, like intelligent wombs that could control their output consciously. The priesthood of bio-people existed primarily to service the machines, to charge them with protoplasm, bone meal, and power. In a modern human legion, we didn't really heal the sick and mend the injured. We recycled them and rebuilt them from scratch. It was easier that way. The machines could reproduce a person by turning raw biological materials into a living being. After a period of time that varied somewhat, always more than 10 minutes, but never more than a half an hour, the machines could churn out a new human being that was a clone of a previously killed soldier. There were two astounding tricks to this technology as I understood it. One was their ability to restore our minds, as well as our bodies, to their original state. They did this by reading stored data. When I'd first joined the Legions, that data had been stored on a tiny silver disk like a coin. But now it was constantly updated on my tapper. Embedded in our bodies, tappers continuously recorded our mental engrams and the state of our synapses and neurons. What was a tapper, after all, other than a built-in semi-biological computer? Just like any mobile computer, tappers had a relatively small storage capacity, only enough to store a few quintillion bytes of data. That was enough, however, to record changes in our neural network rather than the entire thing. They monitored our brains for tiny alterations. Combined with the originally stored engrams in the mainframes, the revival machines could be used to rebuild our memories and personalities. As if all that wasn't enough, the second amazing capacity of the revival systems was the speed with which they operated. Hell, a human woman took 9 months just to grow a baby, and the average infant only weighed a few kilos. How could these machines work so fast? According to the speculation of our best science people, these wondrous alien devices could accelerate time within their confines, and thus gestate a full human in an unbelievably short period. With these combined powers, it was easy to see why they were so valuable. Imported from the core systems and paid for with hard-earned galactic credits, there were few devices I was aware of that cost more. Only starships like Minotaur herself were more expensive. With the critical goal of securing the revival machines firmly in mind, we penetrated the innermost layers of Blue Deck. Each meter of deck we stepped over in the core chambers was packed with death. All the bio people we found were dead. Some of the revival machines were damaged too, but apparently the aliens hadn't found them threatening enough to destroy. I was glad for that. When we broke through into the innermost chambers, I found Anne Grant personally. She was a bio who I'd had an affair with on my last campaign. She was slumped over her revival unit trying to protect it with her body as a woman might defend a helpless child. Her back was a patchwork of burn holes. Acids had penetrated her smart cloth uniform and sizzled into her flesh. Her fair skin was still smoking in places. "Damn it," I said, prying her clutching fingers from the maw of the revival machine and placing her gently on the floor. As I closed her eyes with my fingers, someone eagerly clanked past me to inspect the machine.
"I think this one is okay," Carlos said, tapping at the console.
The revival machines were semi-biological, as I said,
but they had an electronic data interface grafted on so humans could work with them. Carlos breathed hard as he checked the diagnostic data.
"I've got yellow bars on the fluid levels," he said. "We'll have to fix that. And the free-floating nucleotides are all bound up. We'll have to dump this batch and do a full reset. But, Vet, I think we're in business."
I glanced up at him. I was still kneeling over Anne.
"Don't worry about her, man," he said. "Didn't you hear me? She's coming back. I'll bring her back first, if that's what you want."
Heaving a sigh, I shook my head. "Let her rest for a bit. She had a bad death, I can tell. Get some other bio out to run this contraption."
"You've got it. You feel like helping me?"
"No," I said, and strode out of the chamber. I'd personally operated the revival machines in the past, when I'd had to, but I wasn't like bio people. They practically worshipped these alien contrivances. I didn't even like them. They were disgusting, and if the truth be told, a little frightening. I'd always eyed them the way soldiers had eyed a surgeon's tools throughout time. Bone saws and sharp scoops designed to remove flesh purposefully. These things were instruments of the devil, in my opinion, and the revival machines were the worst of the lot. That said, the alien machines had also come to mean life itself to every legionnaire. We guarded them more closely than we guarded our own lives because they effectively made us immortal. I left Carlos behind because I knew what he was going to do. The dead would be used to reprocess into the living. We recycled our own corpses to form fresh ones in the guts of our wondrous, horrific machines. Like I said, they were disgusting and a little creepy. I didn't want to watch Carlos feed my former girlfriend into the blades to regrow her again. I'd seen enough of that kind of thing. Compared to the work of the bio people, our combat missions were nice and clean. All we did was kill people. We didn't grind them up and process them like raw sausage. Graves caught up with me outside the chamber. He had a glimmer of a smile on his face. That was a rare thing for him.
"McGill," he said, "you did a good job back there at the hatch. I knew you could take out that nest of aliens."
"Thank you, Centurion."
"I just reported into Winslade. We're the first unit to make it this far in, but more support from the cohort is on the way. The other cohorts are patrolling the rim, the engine room, and gold deck. There were numerous breaches, but none so critical as ours. Winslade is very happy."
I thought about that and nodded. I knew what Winslade was probably doing right now. If I had to guess, I'd say he was on the net chatting with Turov, taking personal credit for our hard-fought victory. Graves watched me and chuckled. I could tell he knew what I was thinking.
"You're thinking about Winslade, aren't you?"
"Yes, sir," I admitted.
"It's almost sad to watch you grow up, boy," he said. "You're not the wide-eyed country bumpkin you used to be."
"This can't just be a social call," I said, eyeing him back. "Your orders, sir?"
"You're right again, McGill. I'm here to ask for a little more of your magic. I want you to cheat."
Blinking, I shook my head. "How's that, sir?"
"Bump my troops up in the revival queues. We took this deck back solo, and we saved Winslade's and Turov's bacon, whether they want to admit it or not. I say our people should breathe again first, to hell with the automated queues and priority systems."
I nodded. "I'll try, sir."
"Just do it. I know you've hacked the machines before, among other things."
He left me then, and I stared after him. Just how much did he know about my unsanctioned editing of official equipment? Shrugging, I walked into each of the revival chambers, one at a time, and fiddled with the controls. Carlos and the other bio people that were filtering in from other units squawked at me, but I ignored them. I had orders from Centurion Graves, and I informed them they could take up the matter with him. They grumbled, but no one went out to find Graves and complain. They knew better than to try. Chapter 14. Several hours later, I sat in a lifter riding down toward the planet. The final stages of our approach to the target world had gone smoothly. There had been no further attacks from space.
But few of us thought this battle was over. We watched as the shells reached the target world long before our invasion forces did. Turov made sure to funnel the video of the strike to everyone's tapper. I had to admit it was a morale booster. The combined explosions of a full broadside were always a shocking spectacle. Each warhead packed a multi-megaton wallop. At first, all you saw was a brilliant flash of light, as if a new sun had somehow ignited itself on the surface of the planet. Then, the light kept growing in pulsing waves as more warheads detonated. Finally, the light dimmed and turned orange, while shock waves spread like brilliant raindrops splattering into a puddle. Then even the shock waves vanished, consumed in a looming cloud. To me, the cloud didn't look like a mushroom. It looked more like a bulbous gray growth from out in space.
"The broadsides have done their work," Turov announced confidently.
She'd begun broadcasting again after the invaders were pressed back, and we'd buckled up for the final approach. Sitting in a lifter and craning my neck back to see the Imperator displayed on the ceiling, I marveled at the woman's gall. The alien boarding effort had almost been successful, but she made it sound like a glorious victory.
"The identified base on the enemy world has been obliterated," she said with pride in her voice. "They attempted to board, but were repelled with contemptuous ease. The attack was an utter failure. By the time Winslet's cohort reaches the ground, we will have revived every lost soldier."
Carlos rapped on my breastplate with his gauntlet.
"Hey, look," he said. "The new guy puked."
I glanced down and saw it was true.
"Lau, pull it together, trooper," I chided.
Lau looked sheepish and nodded. I frowned back at him. Last year on Machine World, he'd been in a light unit. Maybe they'd promoted him to the rank of regular and put him in my heavy unit too early.
"Too bad they didn't project Turov's face down on the deck," Carlos remarked. "Lau's puke would have nailed her."
I had to chuckle at that. Carlos was often irritating, but every once in a while he was funny, too. It almost made it worth having him around.
"All of you shut up and listen to Imperator Turov,"
I ordered my squad without conviction. Dutifully, they all gazed back up at the ceiling again, where the Imperator was still droning on.
"We'll take what's left of this planet for the Empire," she said. "The result is inevitable. To help speed the effort, our techs have made a full study of these aliens. It has been determined that the invaders were a form of biological construct. They aren't very intelligent, but they're still dangerous when they get in close. My advice to the infantry is to keep them at range. Such creatures will not stand a chance against a large formation of our troops employing focused fire."
I had to admit she had a point there. It was one thing to get surprised by a grabby alien in a storage closet, but when you put armies up against one another in the open, well, ranged weaponry always won out, because you could put all your fire onto a single point and break an enemy before he could get close.
"The results of the upcoming conflict are a foregone conclusion," Turov continued. "We don't know who made these plant creatures and sent them at us, but it doesn't really matter. In the end, they will fall to our legions. After that, things will get even worse for them. They'll be utterly destroyed by the Imperial fleets that will follow. Our part will be done by then. We'll have added another conquest to the Empire's infinitely long list of victories. These creatures may not yet understand why we're here, or how futile their efforts to resist us truly are. But they will learn. The Empire will not be denied. Justice must..."
She went on like that for a long time. I fuzzed out pretty quickly, as I always did when someone made a speech. When the lifter lurched and began to shake a few minutes later, indicating we'd touched the top of the troposphere, I was relieved. Surely Turov had to stop pep-speeching us now.
"As a final gift," she was saying, I want to leave the brave soldiers of Primus Winslate's cohort with this glorious thought.
Ah, jeez, I whispered. The woman was still going.
But at that precise moment, she stopped talking. She turned her head, frowning, off camera.
Just a moment, she said.
There's a disturbance.
What's that?
Someone talked to her, but we couldn't see who. After a few seconds, she turned back toward the camera sourly.
There appears to be a little life left in the alien constructs that violated this ship's integrity earlier. Do not worry about us. Stay focused on your mission. The other half of your cohort is now being launched from orbit in pods. We're watching this two-pronged attack closely. If the lifter touches down without incident, it will be designated the best approach to a full-fledged invasion. If, on the other hand, the pods make it down and the lifter doesn't, theirs will be the preferred method of insertion into...
She broke off, jumped a little, and glared off camera. Carlos and I exchanged quizzical glances. What the hell was going on now? More green pods from space? We'd figured the alien invaders were wiped out.
I'm sorry,
Imperator Turov said, returning to her audience.
Tribune Drusus is now telling me that we have confirmed invaders in the engine section. Apparently, they've been burning their way through the thicker hull and radiation shielding since their initial attack. The shielding was so thick it took many hours to melt the hull and achieve access. They're tenacious beasts, I have to give them that. But have no concern. They will be defeated just as they were on the prior occasion. I have no doubt.
Again, Turov paused and looked around. The camera tilted a little, then righted itself. Turov had been jostled. There was no other explanation. For some reason, I felt a trickle of sweat in my armpits. I wasn't even on Minotaur, but this didn't look good.
When they hit us before, Carlos said, the whole ship never shook once.
I know.
I bet I know what's going on,
Natasha said, leaning in close from my other side. She was a tech specialist I knew well, possibly the best friend I'd ever had.
Talk to us, Carlos said.
Natasha began to explain, and I considered stopping her. Sometimes grim news was bad for morale, but I didn't because I wanted to know the truth myself. Natasha, being a tech and one of the best, always seemed to know what the hell was really going on before I did. Techs communicated privately, and even if she didn't get the best information from her buddies, she was good at divining the truth from observable phenomena and using her logical mind.
The invaders might have breached the core directly, she explained. Think about it. They've probably been melting their way down into the engine all this time, for hours. What happens next all depends on where they broke through. Some might be coming out in the engine room causing a lot of damage, killing engineers. In that case, they could be defeated and repelled just as they were before. But if they came out right inside the reactor itself...
What? Carlos demanded. What then?
Natasha shook her head.
They could rupture the cooling jacket. They could release the heat and radiation from the core. There could be an explosion which would disrupt the entire ship.
My eyes flicked back up to the ceiling, but Turov had vanished. The signal had gone dark. I said, running my eyes over the metal roof of the deck. Did she say anything before shutting off the transmission?
You weren't listening, were you? Carlos said with a dirty laugh. She said she would reconnect when we landed. She was going to personally oversee the defeat of this second boarding attempt.
I looked at Natasha, who nodded in confirmation.
Unit, this is Graves, said a gravelly voice I knew too well. We'll soon lose contact with Minotaur. We're in the upper atmosphere now, and we're in for some turbulence until we reach lower altitudes. When we reach the ground, I'm sure we'll hear the rest of the Imperator's glorious speech.
A few dared to groan.
Hey,
I said to Natasha,
do you have one of your bugs planted upstairs?
She'd been watching her tapper. She looked at me and nodded. She piped her feet over to me, and Carlos craned his neck to watch. Natasha was a bundle of technological surprises. One thing she liked to do was release a buzzer, a tiny spy drone, into the air of any ship we were flying in.
By directing it to a portal, in this case one in the upper decks, which were reserved for crewmen and officers, she was able to get an external view of space. I watched the transmission with interest. The mysterious, overgrown planet loomed, filling the image with its purplish-green vegetation and fluffy white clouds. As I watched, the steamy atmosphere of the target world consumed us. "Turn it back into space," I said. "Get a shot of Minotaur." Natasha worked her controls, and the camera angle shifted. By sending the buzzer crawling up the glass, she was able to get a clear image between two droplets of condensation.
"There," she said to me. "I've zoomed in as far as I can. A buzzer's cameras aren't really designed for long-distance shots."
I saw a silvery white tube surrounded by the blackness of space.
"Is that Minotaur?" "I sure hope so," she said. "If it's not, we have more company in this system than we thought."
"The ship is venting something," Carlos said. "You see that?"
Squinting, I could barely make out what he was talking about. Then I saw it clearly for a moment. A plume of gas was jetting from the aft modules.
"Doesn't look like much," I commented.
Natasha chewed her lower lip and stared.
"At this scale, that plume is better than a kilometer long. It's almost as long as the ship itself."
I looked at her in alarm. "That sounds pretty bad. We have to tell Graves."
"What the hell for?" Carlos demanded. "All that will do is get the buzzers swatted, or us. Get away from me, McGill. I never saw anything."
He scooted as far from me as possible and stared in the opposite direction. Natasha continued to watch the grainy image on her tapper until it was shrouded by the gray clouds that had begun surrounding our lifter as it descended. We were bouncing around now, deep in the troposphere. Ignoring them both, I contacted Graves. I felt I might have information that could affect his command decisions. Commanders needed input to make the right decisions.
"This had better be good, Miguel,"
Graves answered. "Sorry, sir, I have to report something. Minotaur appears to be venting from her aft modules. I believe her engines have been damaged."
"How the hell? Are you hacking into command chat again?"
"No, sir."
"Well then shut up, we know about it. Brace yourselves, we're trying to find a break in the megaflora, and when we do, we'll slip into the lower ecosystem of this planet. Be prepared for anything. Graves out."
The channel closed. I turned to Natasha, who looked scared.
"They know about it," I told her.
"The officers are in contact with Minotaur, and they're doing what they can." She nodded and looked at the floor. "What's wrong?" I asked.
"I'm scared, that's what."
"We've faced death before. Don't let it get you down." She looked at me for a second, then she leaned close.
"James," she said in a low voice, "I don't think there are any revival units aboard this lifter."
"Why wouldn't they bring at least one?"
I asked in alarm.
"Think about it. Why would the brass send something so valuable down with a ship that they half expect will blow up during the descent?"
I blinked, then frowned. The more I thought about it, the more worried I became. The trouble was, she could be right. They normally sent lifters on landings with a revival machine to support the cohort, but this mission had been deemed a dangerous experiment. If they lost a lifter and a cohort, well, that was one thing, but a revival unit? The brass didn't like to lose those. Not at all. And that meant...
"We can't recover,"
I said aloud. Natasha looked back at me. Her face had reddened as if she was holding back tears. Natasha was probably the smartest person in the unit, but she wasn't the toughest. I extended my hand toward hers, and she clasped it.
"You've got it now,"
she said in a hushed tone.
"If we lose Minotaur, they can't revive us, and we can't revive them. We'll be stuck down there on the surface, assuming we survive this landing, with only one life left to live."
Giving her hand a tiny squeeze, I manufactured a smile.
"Don't worry," I said.
"Legion Varus has wiped before, and we'll wipe again. We've faced death, even permadeath, countless times, and we're still here." My words had been meant to be supportive,
but judging by the look on her face, I hadn't cheered her up at all. Chapter 15. We found our hole in the upper canopy of the megaflora. Natasha showed me this on her tapper, which was still getting vid data from the lifter's upper decks. Down in the hold, the soldiers around me were in a grim mood. But if I had to wager, I'd say the mood among the officers upstairs had to be even worse. This planet already looked like a bad one to me. I'd only visited 5 planets before, including Earth, but I'd never seen anything like what they were calling megaflora. "Are those really trees?" I asked Natasha. "I mean, they've got to be a kilometer or two high, and a couple 100 meters thick as well."
"They're not exactly trees," she said, studying her screen. "They have spongy-looking pods on top, and looking at the coloring, there's almost as much purple as there is green."
She was right. I could see purple, green, and various shades of brown. The growths were definitely alien. No one would confuse them with earthly trees. But their structure was still familiar. The lower portions were knotted and thick, clearly what we would call the roots. The center was dominated by a massive trunk in most cases. The upper regions were where things looked the most unusual. The roof of the forest, to use a familiar word, was tightly packed with stuff that looked more like a crown of broccoli than a treetop. Of course, the imagery filtering to us on our tappers wasn't perfect. It was choppy and fuzzy. The monstrous growths we were seeing didn't even look real. They were just too big. The plants even had hazy clouds floating between the trunks like the tallest of Earth's buildings. "What I don't get is how we managed to get through that canopy at all in the lifter," I said. "I don't see any holes in the forest roof other than the one we came in through." Natasha glanced at me.
"There was a hole because we put it there. The burn marks and the size of the opening indicate we blasted it into existence with our broadsides. I'm almost certain of that."
I nodded, getting the point. We'd blown a hole in the forest, then dropped the lifter into it. It made sense, and it also put us close to our target area. Shortly after gliding into the forest and finding a relatively open spot on the ground, the lifter landed. We were between 2 roots of a particularly massive growth. The roots were like folds in a mountain. "We made it down alive, anyway," I said. Carlos clapped me on the shoulder, and he was grinning again.
"That was a good call, Vet," he said. "I would have put my money on the drop pod people, but I would have been wrong."
"What?"
"I'm saying it was a good idea to come down with the lifter instead of the drop pods."
Blinking at him, I frowned. "I didn't have anything to do with that decision, Specialist." He raised his eyebrows in surprise.
"No? I figured you'd gone up to Gold Deck and offered Turov a freebie if she gave you your choice."
I try not to smack Carlos around too much, but sometimes I can't help myself. I clamped onto his neck with my gauntlet and gave him a shake. My fist thumped into his breastplate, but that didn't even leave a scratch. "Why are you such a smartass, Carlos?" I demanded. "Aren't you ever going to grow up?"
"They keep resetting me back to the day I joined up. That means I'm permanently immature, and it's not my fault."
I let him go and stood up. The lifter had cycled down the engines, and the go lights had flipped to green. The big ramp was opening up, and it was time to move out. Fortunately, I wasn't among the first squads to deploy. Graves's entire unit was, in fact, slated to be the last to lead the lifter. We didn't waste any time checking our weapons, shouldering our rucks, or staring at the exit. Sometimes the first few minutes on a new world were the worst of all.
"Look alive, people," Graves said in our ears. "Don't push and don't screw up. We don't have any intel on this planet other than the confirmed fact that it's hostile."
"No shit,"
Carlos muttered. We watched tensely as the first platoons hustled off the lifter ahead of us. My heart pounded, and I watched Natasha as much as anything else. She was reading incoming data on the planet we'd just invaded.
"Breathable atmosphere,"
she said.
"But I'm getting a lot of biologicals in the air. Pollen, spores, traces of unknown pathogens.
Experimentally, I lifted my legs and stomped my feet back down. Gravity seems pretty close to Earth's.
I'm reading about 81% of normal,
Natasha said. That's
nice for sore feet.
Nice for giant tree growths, too, I said. With a lower gravitational pull, it has to be easier for these plants to get taller. She nodded in agreement. Eventually, we were ordered to disembark. We gathered in a loose formation on the ground, taking up a flanking spot alongside one of the giant tree roots.
I don't hear anything, except for us,
Carlos said, messing with his audio inputs.
No bird songs? No jungle cat roars? Just silence.
I listened, and I had to admit he was right. I'd been in plenty of forests in my time, and I'd never visited a quieter place. Natasha prowled around, reading instruments, while Carlos pecked at the tree roots with his medical instruments. I didn't stop either of them. I was hoping one of them might come up with something interesting.
Listen up, people, Graves said at last, gathering the unit. We've landed just a kilometer north of the big hole we blasted in this forest. Our readings aren't giving us any data on enemy positions, but those invaders up on Minotaur had to come from somewhere. Let's spread out and search the region by squads. If you make any kind of contact, report in. Otherwise, come back to camp under the lifter within an hour's time.
Only one unit stayed with the lifter to protect it. The rest of us split up and began exploring the immediate vicinity. None of us were supposed to leave sight of the lifter, just in case. Among the knot of officers in the middle of the defensive unit, I spotted Primus Winslade himself. I pointed him out to Carlos as we climbed on top of an oversized root.
Figures, Carlos said, following my gaze. Winslade isn't going on patrol. He'll sit back here and sip wine until we bump our noses into something. Then he'll call for help, screaming.
He was probably right, but I ignored Carlos's complaints anyway. I watched as Winslade moved to talk to Graves and the other Centurions. Something was up. After a few minutes of huddling and talking in low voices, Graves overrode our channel and made an announcement.
Platoon leaders, join me in the lifter, he said.
Graves then followed Winslade up the ramp into the shadowy interior of the lifter. A half dozen other officers gathered behind him. Carlos nudged me.
What?
I demanded.
You better get going, he said.
What are you talking about?
Leeson's still dead. Last time our platoon had a leader, it was you. That means you're up, dummy.
Squinting at him, I was too surprised to smack him one. For one thing, he was technically right. The way Legion Chain of Command worked, if there wasn't an adjunct handy, command was handed down to a veteran. Normally, the most senior veteran was given the honor, which would have been Harris. But Graves had specified me for the job back aboard the ship. Legion soldiers died a lot. Because of this, we often had holes in our ranks until people were revived. In the past, prior to revival systems, new commanders would have been sent out to the front, or units would fold into one another to form full-strength formations. But with our revival technology in play, death was usually just an inconvenience. Lower-level officers automatically moved up the chain to replace their superiors until the dead man returned to take over his job again. Standard routine. Shrugging, I walked toward the ramp. At the bottom of it, I felt a heavy gauntlet slam down on my shoulder. It didn't hurt, as my epaulets were over a centimeter thick, but it was irritating. I swung around with a frown. Harris glared at me.
"Just where the fuck do you think you're going, McGill?" he demanded.
"Up this ramp. Graves just summoned the platoon leaders to a conference, didn't you hear?"
"I heard. I heard all right. He was talking to me, you fool. I'm your senior by a decade. Don't think for a second you've got the right to play this kind of game with me."
"You're right, vet," I said. "I don't mean to play any games. Maybe we should clear this up with Graves right now." Turning, I stepped up the ramp again. Harris caught up to me with a growl and yanked on my arm. You can ask anyone and they'll swear I've got a slow fuse. But this planet was hot and steamy. Too much heat always put me into a bad mood. I could feel the humidity coming right through my armor, making my skin prickle. It was like being inside a car in a jungle. Sure, you might have air conditioning, but systems like that were never perfect. My body knew it was standing in a sweaty sauna. The little bit of cool air that was pissing on my skin in a half dozen spots didn't do all that much to relieve my discomfort. The long and short of it was that I just about punched Harris. He knew what I was thinking, too. He'd grabbed me once, and I'd taken that in stride. But both of us knew that grabbing me twice was too much. He could tell I was on the verge of jumping him, so he dropped his hands from my arm. That was good for both of us. I took a deep breath and forced a smile. "You've got something to add, Harris?"
"I sure as hell do. We'll clear this up right here, right now. Call Graves."
"You call him," I shot back. We stared each other down for a second. Harris liked to hide from his officers. He tried to never be the man to bring them a problem. But I wasn't going to be tricked into being the whiny guy with a question for the boss, not this time. With a growl, Harris brought up his tapper and opened a channel to Graves. I was right there, so I overheard everything.
"Centurion, sir," Harris said, his voice as perky as he could muster. "There's a small misunderstanding, sir." "Specify, Harris. I'm busy."
Harris cleared his throat.
"Sir, McGill and I were wondering which of us should be attending the command meeting in the lifter as Adjunct Leeson's replacement."
Graves hesitated.
"Yes, right," he said. "I did put McGill in command, didn't I?"
Harris frowned fiercely. I could tell he'd expected an immediate decision in his favor.
"Sir," he said, "perhaps we could both attend, if that would be more convenient." "It wouldn't be. It's too crowded up here already. My orders stand. Send McGill. Graves out."
Harris's mouth hung open. He stared at his tapper in shock. Right then, I felt bad. Sure, Harris and I had never been best buddies, but we'd fought to the death back-to-back more times than we'd killed one another. He was the senior man. I suddenly felt that I shouldn't have pushed for this, that I should have backed down and let Harris have his day in the sun without me horning in. "Vet," I said, "I'm sorry about this. I didn't mean to make a big deal of the situation. Why don't you just go up there and tell him I'm helping an injured soldier on my squad?" Harris eyed me. His jaw muscles were bulging and his lips were squirming. I could tell he was upset and didn't know how to react.
"That's a nice gesture," he said. "But the Centurion has given a command. I'm not like you, McGill. I follow orders. Get your ass up there and attend that meeting."
Turning away, I left him there at the bottom of the ramp.
"I hope the whole damn lifter blows up and kills a lot of you,"
Harris shouted after me as I disappeared into the dim interior. I chuckled to myself as I made my way to the upper decks. Now that was the Harris I knew so well. When I reached the conference chamber, it turned out I was the only non-com in the room. I barely made it inside before the hatch in the floor glided shut and locked. I frowned at that. Was this a secret meeting? Winslade stood in front of the central tactical display. Lifters were equipped with a decent battle simulation computer, so they could operate as a headquarters for land or space-based forces in a pinch.
"I'm not going to soften this," Winslade said. "We've got serious problems. Critical decisions must be made immediately."
These dramatic words surprised me, so I decided it would be best to stay as invisible as possible. I stood in the very back, leaning up against the curving hull. I was so far back, the ship's walls pressed against my helmet. Looking around the room, I frowned. Hadn't Graves said something about it being cramped up here? Well, it wasn't. The chamber was designed to house all the officers in a full cohort. Lifters carried 1,000 troops, and the officers were supposed to use the primary chamber of the upper decks as a meeting area. The odd thing was, the room was mostly empty. With only half the cohort with us, there was half the usual number of officers. I could have snagged a comfy chair if I'd had the balls to. Did that mean Graves had wanted me up here and decided to let Harris down easy with an excuse? Or was this just his way of slapping Harris around for complaining about his orders back when we were in the face of the enemy on Blue Deck? I didn't know the answer, so I tried to push these thoughts from my mind and listen closely to Winslade. He tended to be overly dramatic, but he seemed to be serious today.